This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay tuned for a review of the week in WMRA news. There is a lot to cover, including Jesse Nadler's look at why the state tends to look the other way as farms pollute the Shenandoah and its tributaries. Faith Pinu's story from Lexington about what you get when you combine classical music, nature sounds, and the power of the sun, and whether the way Virginia now executes those on death row is cruel and unusual. But first, the Ku Klux Klan paid a visit to Charlottesville last weekend in what was perhaps the most anticipated event of the year for the city. Thousands of people came out, some to protest indirectly through celebration, and others who wanted to look the KKK in the face. And as WMRA's Jordy Yeager and Emily Richardson Lorente report in this excellent team coverage, there was violence, but not until after the KKK rally was over.
Scores of state and local police gathered on Saturday morning among dozens of metal barricades that snaked their way through Justice Park. It used to be called Jackson Park for the giant Stonewall Jackson statue in its center. In fact, the Klan was coming to protest the park's renaming and the proposed removal of a Robert E. Lee statue just two blocks away. As bomb-sniffing dogs circled the park, small religious and spiritual groups gathered, weathering the calm before the impending storm that would draw more than 1,000 protesters, culminating in riot gear, tear gas, and the arrest of 22.
But before any of that, across town, folks were gathering for a different purpose.
Here at the Ix Art Park, it's a potluck, not a protest. This is just one of many community events happening today, all designed to give residents a reason to keep away from the KKK.
The goal has been, don't take the bait.
That's Charlottesville Mayor Mike Signer. Since the Klan rally was first announced, he's encouraged people to stay away, and he's helped spearhead a full day of alternate events through an effort called Unity Seaville.
And all this is meant to give people a really rich, wonderful alternative to the display of hate and division, this kind of sideshow that has come to our town from this totally discredited organization.
One of the potluck participants is 72-year-old Jackie Davis. She feels differently than the mayor about confronting the Klan.
They need to understand that most people in this country don't agree with their ideas.
She'll be protesting later with a small cardboard sign that reads, "Check your DNA." She's black, but she's not afraid.
I'm not scared. If I would be scared, I'd be scared of the police. Historically, the police have been on the side of the Klan.
What would be the best case scenario in your mind?
Well, this is already the best case scenario for me. I mean, there's free food, great music, everybody's having a wonderful time. There's all kinds of different people here. That's what we need.
After the potluck ends, some of the participants head to the Sprint Pavilion on the pedestrian mall. There's a free concert here, beginning an hour before the rally. Carolyn Hines is playing on the lawn with her 3-year-old daughter. They're not at all interested in attending the KKK rally.
Not at all. There's no way in the world you could convince me to be anywhere near there.
But a few blocks away, at the First United Methodist Church, several hundred people are taking a different approach.
If you see the police acting aggressively, pull out your phone and document it.
I don't believe we should assume that the police are going to be doing bad things. I think we should.
That's Blaze Gaston interjecting. He's a local furniture maker and one of the many white folks here sporting a Black Lives Matter t-shirt.
I guess I've grown up in the civil rights movement since I was this high. And it's sort of terrifying.
With a half hour left before the Klan is set to arrive, Blaze and everyone else here is preparing to march on Justice Park, where they plan to protest peacefully, despite the mayor's advice to stay away.
I want to see it from my own eyes, and I'm not sure I agree with him. I think the more people there showing that we disapprove of them is better.
A few minutes later, they're off, headed 3 blocks away, prepared to face the KKK.
By 3 o'clock, more than 1,000 people have flooded Justice Park and the surrounding streets. Hundreds of police form a human funnel, allowing about 50 members of the loyal White Knights of the KKK to march into a penned-off area near the base of the Jackson statue. There, a Klansman shouts racist remarks into a microphone hooked up to a small speaker. He's completely drowned out by the crowd. Several plastic water bottles, oranges, and even tomatoes get thrown at the Klan. One Klansman carries a holstered handgun on his hip, and their Imperial commander, Amanda Barker, makes her rounds to the media as the group's spokeswoman.
I'm white. I'm proud of that statue.
After about 45 minutes, the Klan leaves the park. A police helicopter hovers above as the massive crowd swarms around the Klan, which, protected by the police, finally leaves peaceably. It's then that things turn south. In front of the city and county courthouses, a group of protesters refuses to clear the downtown street. Police launch 3 canisters of tear gas towards the crowd. People race to find water to flush out their eyes. Eventually, the streets empty out, but not before police arrest 22 people. Police Chief Al Thomas, in a statement, lauded the event as a success, saying order was quickly restored and our community remains safe. But for some, the real work hasn't even begun. Charlottesville resident Rosea Parker urged people to go beyond protests of the statues and dig into the deeper work around the longstanding systemic racism that exists in the city.
You can't turn it into a world-class city if you haven't dealt with the racism that's been hidden and now it's uncovered. But it's a shame that it had to be uncovered through a statue, when there's more pressing issues in Charlottesville that we have more than just that statue.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
And I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente.
And there was a follow-up to this story. On Tuesday last week, Charlottesville Police Chief Al Thomas defended the use of tear gas by the state police during Saturday's events. As you just heard in that report, after the KKK was leaving the rally site, police fired 3 canisters of tear gas to disperse the crowd of protesters. Thomas said that one protester sprayed pepper gel at an officer, and that's when he said the state police decided to use the tear gas. Protest leaders deny that anyone in the crowd used pepper spray. Now to an environmental story. The Shenandoah River was once considered a world-class fishery. Now sections of it are coated in a scummy, potentially toxic algae resulting from manure runoff from farms. Jesse Nadler takes a look at Virginia's water pollution problem and seeks to find out why the state can't or won't protect the Shenandoah and its tributaries, including the Middle River in Augusta County.
The Middle River flows through Bobby Whitescarver and his wife Jean Trimble Hoffman's 40-acre farm in Swope. It looks like chocolate milk.
This is the biggest river in Augusta County, and it's the most polluted.
A big reason is animal waste. The Middle River flows from farm after farm until joining up with the Shenandoah River about 100 miles downstream, and eventually into the Chesapeake Bay. A lot of the riverbanks along the way aren't fenced, allowing cows and the waste they drop into the river. Whitescarver's life's work is restoring watersheds. He says that when the Middle River flows into their farm, it consistently tests 4 times higher for E. coli than the state standard. And one time last year, it tested 25 times higher.
You know, if this was a public recreation, the health department wouldn't let you swim or wade in it.
By the time it flows out of their farm, E. coli levels drop by a third because of fencing and other restoration efforts. But it picks up again because many farms downstream aren't fenced. By the time it joins the Shenandoah, the pollution is worse. Conservationist Herschel Finch says he's noticed a big change in the Shenandoah since he started fishing there in the late 70s. First, there was the massive fish kill in 2005. Then, the discovery of male fish with female parts. And now parts of the river are coated with scummy green algae.
We see periods during the year where the algae pretty much takes over entire sections of the river. It also has a tendency to reach a critical mass, and then it starts to rot and smell, and it just becomes almost unusable.
Why so much algae? Manure is rich in nitrogen and phosphorus. Algae feeds off these 2 nutrients, creating the thick, smelly algae blooms, which can be toxic. Keeping cattle out of streams is just one small part of a much larger problem. The Shenandoah Valley is Virginia's breadbasket, home to hundreds of large-scale cattle and poultry operations, which produce millions of pounds of manure every year. Farmers use this manure as fertilizer, but there's so much of it, the runoff ends up in the river. The Environmental Integrity Project issued a report in April that found the state's system for manure management for big livestock operators to be inadequate. For years, water conservation groups have been after the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality to officially identify the Shenandoah River as impaired, a designation that would require the state to do something about the pollution. Specifically, they want the state to comply with the Federal Clean Water Act, which, among other things, requires permits and pollution controls for big animal feeding operations. But state officials have refused the request because Virginia has no water quality standards for this kind of pollution. Here's DEQ spokesman Bill Hayden.
Until we have scientific evidence of exactly what the problem is, we can't declare an impairment. So if there's an area that's got a lot of algae or doesn't look very appealing, we would just encourage people to avoid that area.
That sounds like stonewalling, says attorney Jennifer Chavez, whose firm represents three citizen groups in a recent lawsuit against the EPA for failing to enforce the Clean Water Act.
There's plenty of evidence already. You know, the state has said that it needs to develop a framework and then a plan and a multi-year cooperative project with other states in the Chesapeake Bay region. And, you know, what we've said is all of that is unnecessary because the fact that this river is in a state of impairment is apparent to anyone who can see or smell.
Back upstream at the Middle River, farmer Bobby Whitescarver weighs in on the problem. On the one hand, he doesn't want to single out farmers, many of whom are natural conservationists. On the other, Virginians require clean water.
Litigation is the tool of last resort. You know, how long have we been working on cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay? 50 years! And people like me, you know, it doesn't happen fast enough, but it's happening. The Chesapeake Bay is getting cleaner. It's being restored, and it starts right here.
He expects the lawsuit will keep the needle moving forward, however slowly. I'm Jesse Nadler.
Earlier this month, Virginia executed William Morva for the murders of a sheriff's deputy and security guard back in 2006. In the final hours of his life, Morva's lawyers raised concerns over how Virginia gets the drugs it uses in executions and why they may not be working properly. And a word in advance, this story contains descriptions of the procedure that may be too intense for some listeners. From Virginia Public Radio, here is Mallory Nopain's report.
Last week, outside Greenville Correctional Center, a small group of anti-death penalty activists held vigil as William Morva was executed. The execution went on despite a last-minute appeal from one of Morva's lawyers, Rob Lee. Lee asked the governor for a reprieve to investigate concerns over one of the drugs used during lethal injection.
And we got a response relatively quickly from the governor's counsel thanking us for bringing the matter to his attention and stating that it had been given careful consideration and the government was going to deny our request for a reprieve.
Lee's concerns came from a news report released the day before. Details about another recent Virginia execution.
Ricky Gray has been sentenced to death.
Horrific and senseless crime devastated the Richmond community.
Ricky Gray will be executed tonight at a prison in Greensville County.
Ricky Gray was executed this past January. Leading up to the date, Virginia officials faced a problem. They didn't have the drugs to kill him. Pharmaceutical manufacturers opposed to the death penalty had stopped supplying them. So Virginia lawmakers struck a deal. They passed a law allowing the state to buy the drugs from a compounding pharmacy instead, a made-to-order drug from a company less closely regulated by the FDA. The law also allowed the state to buy the drugs in secret, shielding the identity of the pharmacy from the public and the press. In January, Gray was executed using a compounded drug called midazolam. Mark Edgar is a pathologist at Emory University.
I can't say, of course, what he experienced. What I can say is that midazolam is not an anesthetic.
Like Xanax or Valium, midazolam is a sedative used to calm people before surgery, but never as the sole anesthetic. In some executions, though, it's used to put inmates to sleep before a second drug paralyzes them and then a third stops their heart. In Oklahoma and Ohio, inmates have woken up after midazolam is administered. As part of his research, pathologist Mark Edgar reviews autopsies from executions. One of the reports that recently landed on his desk was Ricky Gray's, provided by Gray's family. It showed blood-tinged liquid in his airways.
That's something that you don't typically see in a hospital autopsy. That's more characteristic of, for instance, a sarin gas attack. My concern is that it might be like drowning from within, having your lungs fill with fluid and not being able to do anything about it.
Witnesses to Gray's execution described movement and heavy breathing after the compounded midazolam was administered. Edgar says if the drug didn't render Gray fully unconscious, he would have experienced pain, terror, and panic.
It seems like it's coming close to cruel and unusual punishment. If you knew that they were not in any way aware, I wouldn't be concerned. But I don't think we do know that.
Despite the appeals from William Morva's lawyers, he was executed using the same drug. Witnesses described gulping and chest convulsions. A spokeswoman for Virginia's Department of Corrections say the drugs are tested monthly, and there's no plan to discontinue the use of midazolam. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
What do you get when you combine a classical pianist, a controversial presidential election, and the sun? Why, solar-powered nature music, of course. WMRA's Faith Pinu has the story of one musician in Lexington who is taking inspiration from the sound and energy of nature.
What you're listening to is the sound of Woods Creek in Lexington. And those are the sounds of Jonathan Cook, a local musician who is making a living by bringing his classical piano training outdoors.
I constantly spent time in the woods and always wondered why my music and artistic life was separate from this deep love of nature and of environmental issues.
Cook's background is in classical piano. He earned a master's degree in piano performance from University of Michigan, commissioned a few of his own compositions for the New Jersey Music Teachers Association, and he served as musical director and organist at several churches. But a year ago, he decided to explore making music electronically. And then came the presidential election in November, which Cook says was a turning point that motivated him to bring together his love of nature and music.
What I do with my music has to be with renewable energy, has to be for an environmental cause, was a question I answered after the election. I did a lot of soul-searching and questioning in that period of time. Knowing that renewable energy had made so much progress over the last 8 years, and that it was going to roll back, at least in terms of government support from the federal government.
His answer? Solar-powered nature music. It goes like this. First, Cook ventures into nature to collect sound. He has clips of the ocean beating the shore in Oregon, of feet crunching through dry grass in Michigan, and of birds singing right here in Virginia.
Yeah, I've recorded a fair amount in my backyard, actually. One morning I went out, I just took the trash out in the morning, and the birds in the backyard were exquisite.
Once Cook has a good collection of outdoor noise, he then composes pieces of music, incorporating the sounds of nature as though they were just added instrumentation.
It becomes a layer of the music. And what's really neat about that is being able to interact with that layer of sound with the musical layers I'm creating. So if there's waves, for instance, maybe you'll hear a big wave crash and there'll be a wave of a musical part. So I can essentially play a duet with nature.
Now, Cook certainly isn't the first or only musician to compose using nature sounds. But the final step in his process is pretty unusual. All the hours of gathering sound, composing music, and recording in one of his 3 in-home studios is powered through energy from the sun, which Cook collects via 3 solar panels in his backyard. And because everything is run on a solar-powered battery, his keyboard and mixing station are mobile. Cook has performed in a park, on a mountaintop, and most recently, during a Rockbridge community yoga class.
Well, yoga to me, I connect that a lot with nature to begin with. The poses, the feeling,
the whole experience of yoga. I always visualize being out in nature when I do yoga.
That's Jessica Sullivan, a 52-year-old early education coordinator at Boxerwood Garden in Lexington. She attended the yoga class at Lilburn Downing Community Center, where Cook performed his nature songs. She says the connection between the music and yoga teacher Karen Stanley helped her to focus on her practice.
I really felt like the sounds of nature just brought me right back to where I needed to be for the practice. The type of music that he had working in there, no chanting or words, really helped with my breathing. I enjoyed the experience a lot.
Cook's solar-powered nature music has become pretty popular in Lexington. Karen Stanley, the yoga teacher, says that attendance at the weekly Rockbridge Community Yoga practice has been dwindling. But on the Saturday in June that Cook performed, 26 yogis showed up, more than double the normal class size. In addition to giving local performances and playing in yoga classes, Cook is working on putting out an EP entitled Salute the Sun. He plans to release it at the end of August. For WMRA News, I'm Faith Pinu.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how you can support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. All of our stories are archived at that website. Also, be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And don't forget to keep up each morning by subscribing to the WMRA Daily. The Daily is a podcast that brings you the latest local, regional, and statewide news and WMRA feature stories every weekday morning. Find it at WMRA.org. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.